Matthew, he says, I will never understand Byron. My wife is married to another man. My daughter is in love with pop songs about sex and money, while Byron offers nothing but Seville and oranges. I can't tell if he loves me or not. My professor shrugs like all dead men shrug, stands up and walks out of my room like all men, dead or alive, slowly, with his head bent to the task of leaving. Waking up in the early morning, half dressed for a dream about ballroom dancing, my coattails fluttering in long black strips behind me, top hat pulled down over my eyes, and half dressed for breakfast, my pajama bottoms covered with flickering hotel signs, I remember that I live alone. And because I live alone, I take the palm trees far too seriously, depend far too much on my books, lined up like a third grade class preparing for recess, all wearing different coats, some pushing and pulling at their classmates. If you live alone with a smile thin as a paper cut, your dead English professor coming around every other night in tears, an empty mailbox and a neighbor that puts her cigarettes out near begonia, you should not hang yourself. Tell the palm tree you love him. Light a candle and offer yourself up to the books. Haven't they saved your life once before? Reading Allen Ginsberg the day your friend cut himself open in the back seat of his car, the engine running while his mother was getting high off a plastic bag of tape thinner, a bluish ring around her mouth. You could have been in that car. You could have been like her. But you sat on the floor and pulled Lucille Clifton off the shelf instead. As if that were not enough to make you shiver, while the angel of fate passed you over, somewhere in New Jersey, you have Bruce Springsteen writing songs about you and wondering how you are. We fall in love with the art that we fall in love with. And does it really love us back? Does it matter if it loves us back? It can still save our life, whether it does or it doesn't. In 1981, Bruce Springsteen came off of his tour for the River album. His most successful tour, his most successful album. He had a hit single in the charts with Hungry Heart. He was actually making money for the first time in his career. He's a perfectionist, so he spent a lot of his money on the studio making his records. So he didn't have any money in his pocket until then. So once he had all that money, what he did was he retreated from everyone he knew, his band, the few friends he had outside of the music industry, broke up with his girlfriend, and kind of hid out in a really nondescript house in Colts Neck, New Jersey, where the only interesting characteristics of the house was the bedroom was covered in this hideous orange shag rug, which it still is. There, you can visit it. And he started with a four-track recorder making recordings for what he thought would be the next band record. And he did that alone in the bedroom with his guitar and a couple of other instruments. And so he made this tape and he took it to the band a little while later, a few months later, and said, this is going to be the next record. And they tried to record those songs and it didn't work. It started pretty encouragingly. I think the first song they recorded was Born in the USA. And that seemed like it was going to be a good session, but then it just all fell apart. So they tried recording it every which way with the band. None of those songs worked. Figured, well, he recorded it alone in the bedroom. Just put him in the studio with a guitar. That'll be the record. That didn't work. Nothing sounded right. They couldn't figure it out. This tape that he had made, which was a shitty little Maxell tape that you could buy in a grocery store, that I remember making mixtapes on when I was a kid could not be translated into any other form. It existed as it was. And they tried, the highest paid people in the music industry tried to transfer that music to a more acceptable commercial sound. It never worked. The songs resisted it. So eventually it just became, well, this is the record. It's just this tape. Then they had to figure out how to get that tape onto a record. And that caused a lot of problems. What I find really reassuring about that story is that despite our very best efforts to fuck it up, good art will resist those efforts. And that art will exist on its own terms and find its own audience and be its own living, breathing thing, no matter what we attempt to do to it. And I think that's very reassuring to know that whatever I do or whatever we do, however much we fall in love with a piece of art or wonder what the artist is thinking, it doesn't really matter. The art exists on its own, and we come to it on our own, each on its own terms. And that is the relationship we forge. And that is the relationship that matters and carries on. And I just think that's a really beautiful thing. So without further ado, talking about beauty, Joan Bauer is coming up to tell you about what else is going on. Well, thanks for coming up. Thank you.
So happy to see you all here tonight. This is great. Look at all these folks here. We must have a bunch of friends here. This is wonderful. How about that? Not the regulars, not the Hemingway regulars. This is wonderful. So we have four poets reading tonight: Paula Corso, Tween Das, Shaheen Dill, Barbara Edelman. They're going to read in that order. I'm going to do a brief bio on each of them. At the end of the reading, we will be pausing for a photograph. And you have an entire room of amazing books. And I would point out that this is a bookstore. And the authors, the poets reading tonight, have books. There are other books. There's biographies, novels, all sorts of stuff. Novels, we should come out of here with a book. Okay. I would also remind you that in 2 weeks, just so you can mark your calendar, okay, the Hemingway Summer Poetry Series will feature Ace Bogus, Deb Bogan, who's here tonight, Mike Schneider, and Judy Vollmer. We want you to be back for that. But for tonight, here we go. Paula Corso's fiction and poetry books are set in her native Pittsburgh, where her Italian immigrant family members were steel workers. Her books include The Laundress Catches Her Breath, Once I Was Told the Air Was Not for Breathing, and her latest and wonderful book, Vertical Bridges, Poems and Photographs of City Steps. She is the co-founder of Step and Stanzas, and she is proud to be included on Pennsylvania Center for Books Library Literary Map. And if you want to know more, you can go to www.paulacorso.com. Please welcome Paula.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Joan, Chris, Hemingway Series, hosting tonight, the bookstore, thank you all for coming. When I'm fortunate enough to have a reading in Pittsburgh, I start with a prayer. Would you join me? In the name of the Allegheny and of the Monongahela and the Holy Ohio, amen. Okay, I'm reading from Bird of the Bridges, poems and photographs of city steps. And I thought I'd read from a section tonight that tracks the immigrant experience. And each section of this book has a photograph and a quote. And the quote for this section is a Dante quote. Thou shalt find how salt another's bread is wont to taste, and what a painful thing is going up and down another's stairs. Okay, this first poem is called Arrival, and it is in three sections. One, January 1st, 1892. A teenager from Ireland and her two younger brothers skipped two steps at a time up the main staircase to Ellis Island. A chorus of foghorns, peals of church bells, steam whistles, and cheers as the first immigrant passes through. What is your name, my girl? Annie Moore, sir. Registry book signed, handed a $10 gold piece. Chaplain's blessing, wishes for a happy new year, escorted to the waiting room into the arms of her parents. Two, May 20th, 1905. A Polish woman with three little children climbs the steps from the pier to Ellis Island. Baggage room, registry room, more steps to public health as she takes a 6-second physical. How quickly she climbs, how high she lifts her legs, how tightly she grips the railing, how labored her breath. Next, a test for intelligence. The question: would you wash the stairs from the top down or the bottom up? The woman's curt reply: I do not come to America to wash stairs. Three, the Immigration Act of 1924. A stonemason from Sicily climbs the steps from the pier to Ellis Island. If he were given the same physical and asked the same question, he would think of hundreds of steps he built from the sea to his hill town, an Italian's pyramid to the heavens. Then he could answer, I come to America with mallet and chisel, no broom. But a doctor measures his head and body parts, too short, too dark and hairy, ears too big. A commission concludes that certain kinds of behavior are inherent in the Italian race. Crimes of violence, robbery, blackmail are peculiar to the people of Southern Italy. A quote unquote natural born criminal climbs down the steps from Ellis Island to the pier. Savage, the report says, and a rapist, rejected.
Well, we have a little music break there.
Thanks so much. Okay, this next poem is American Future. It is actually translated in Italian, but I'm just going to read the English tonight. This is a memory of my father, Mariano Procopio Corso. Snapshot of my father as a young man standing at the top of Hillside Steps, wearing a double-breasted suit and tie, pants creased, shoes polished, his back to the steel mill in the valley behind him, his back to the jackhammer he used to drill on the labor gang. It's 70 pounds to his 145. The crane he operated in a sweaty cabin above a coal-fired furnace, his back to chain-smoking staffs, to chain-smoking beer gardens, to the jackass work he skipped one day. And when his father found out, he belted him before he told his son, "Mario, you better learn to use your head and not your hands." As he wore white collars best, striking a pose for the camera, feet anchored on higher ground, my father set his sights ahead. Not at a Pittsburgh mill, not his native Calabria or Santo Procopio, not the patron saint he was named after for sharing the same July 8th birthday, but sign his middle name, Paul, instead of Procopio. Not the steps he climbed onto a boat crossing the ocean in steerage herds, steps where his mother led him by the hand, pushed him through the classroom door each morning because he was a WOP who couldn't speak English, a WOP who flunked his grade of school. Steps to a job at the mill after high school, running and jumping down with a lunch bucket swinging from his hand, punching in on time with the rank and file. Steps up to a World War II fighter plane as a tail gunner in the Pacific Theater, then to college on the GI Bill, to the stage to accept his diploma, to a newspaper office, government office, school administration office, suit and tie office. What was my Italian father thinking as he faced his American future, double-breasted for the camera? What he didn't know, couldn't know. He turned his back on his immigrant past, but his cancer faced front. Dead center front, dead center lungs. I'm going to read two more poems, and this one is a current event, believe it or not, or maybe you do believe it. It's called An Emergency, and this is a set of stairs in Chatsworth, Georgia. An 87-year-old Syrian woman climbs down one step at a time, one hand holding onto the rail, the other a steak knife. She slowly makes her way to a wooded area. She stoops down, reaches for dandelion greens to cut them, toss them into her apron pocket, toss them into her husband's salad bowl with lemon and garlic. Dispatcher, what's your emergency? Caller, there's a lady walking on the bike trails. She has a knife and she won't leave. She doesn't speak English. A police car pulls up. Three officers pull out their guns. The woman doesn't drop the steak knife despite their commands and attempt to show her how. Police tase her. Dot red, stun red, sting red burning her skin, electric red, shock red, enough volts to stop her heart. That night, there's one less knife in the kitchen drawer. That night, her husband eats salad dressed with lemon and garlic. Salad without dandelion greens. He doesn't know why. And this last poem is called On the Way Up. And as we know, there are hundreds and hundreds of steps, some debating what figure you want to go with, some anywhere between 739 and 900. But we're all hopefully walking them to get exercise, to get where we're going to go, and to celebrate them. We know that there are various events in the city. And this one was inspired by the step trek in the South Side. On the way up, as we climb these steps, look out on our city, ribbons of river, bridges arching their golden spines, duet of valley and hill. As we look out to buildings huddled together, a fountain pluming in the mist, an incline zippering up its track. Remember the immigrant who came here, his chisel and his mallet, to build these steps with concrete fists. Remember him on a steep hill, standing on an edge, the width of his feet, the width of misstep and fall, standing with his pick, picking away at a glacier of rock, dirt up his nose, dust in his eyes, grit between his teeth. And down his neck, a foreman who brushes his top coat, adjusts his bowler hat, glances at his pocket watch to time lunch. Each step we take, a step in the past, our ancestors, their uncertain futures, we on steady ground. Each step, a step in the future, new immigrants on the way up. And for every step we take, they take three. One forward, one backward, and one waiting. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Paula. It's wonderful. That was real. So, Tuan Das is a Bangladeshi poet. In 2016, his exile to the United States was spurred by threats of violence by Al-Qaeda-linked extremist groups intent on, guess what, limiting freedom of expression. He found refuge in Pittsburgh when Carnegie Mellon University invited him to be here as a visiting scholar, and later when City of Asylum invited him to join their Writer Sanctuary Program, and he was granted political asylum here in 2022, Exile Poems in the Labyrinth of Homesickness, his U.S. poetry debut, was published by Bridge and Tunnel Books here in Pittsburgh. And we're going to please welcome Tuan Das, and we're going to also have some printed copies of some of these poems for your, so you can follow along as well.
Thank you again. Yeah, so this book called Exile Poems, this book was published in 2022 by Bridge and Tunnel Books. And here is my publisher, Heather McCaldwell. Hi, Heather. So I am delighted to be here, all of you. And thanks to Hemingway's Summer Poetry Series and White Wall Bookstore for inviting me to read. It is a true pleasure to hear all the lovely poets this evening. So I am from Bangladesh, which is an Asian nation located Southeast India. So before coming to America, I wrote articles about political and social issues, such as against religious persecution, Islamist fundamentalism, and peace and harmony between different communities. So because of my writing, my name was published by hit list, in a hit list by extremist, Bangladeshi extremist. So then I came to Pittsburgh in 2016. And I started writing the poems of this book. So tonight I will share 10 poems from this book in English, and I'm going to read one poem in my home language, Bengali, at the end. So between 2013 and 2018, more than 100 writers, bloggers, and activists, the Bangladeshi activists, all demanded secularism, which means they wanted more personal freedom, were threatened with death by fundamentalists. So among them, more than 50 people from different religions and ethnic groups were victims of ruthless targeted killings. So in reaction, dozens of writers and activists left the country and now live their lives in exile in different countries around the world, including me. So I am one of them. Exile poem one. All the writers were living under death threats. So why should I step back in my land? The thought kept floating up, a question like the corpse of a refugee lying on the coast by the sea, its existence irrelevant next to the vast expanse of water. I had wanted to be that minority who would be the last to flee the country. I wanted to be last one because my family background is Hindu, and Hindu families are leaving Bangladesh. They are going to India or different countries because of persecution. So I left Bangladesh on 1st of April 2016. And I was at the airport in the capital city, Dhaka, and completed my immigration proceedings. So I was waiting for boarding, and I called a few trustworthy friends, but they thought I was pranking them because it was the 1st of April, April Fool's Day, you know? So we normally prank each other. So I gave up trying to tell my friends I was leaving the country, and when they didn't believe me. And also that was the Dhaka airport. Now, also at Abu Dhabi airport, I felt nervous because I knew I was leaving my home country for such a long time, at least for more than a decade. So the uncertainty caused me to feel vulnerable. I just needed to see a familiar face at Abu Dhabi airport. Just I needed to talk with someone and see it, but didn't find anybody. Exile poems too. And then I did leave my country. I abandoned everything. My intercontinental past, passing on my journey, the silent sky, the river of fear, and the farmland, full of the harvest of death. When I saw those who were sleeping at midnight in the Abu Dhabi International Airport, I thought of walking them to say, "You are my own, each and every one of you." But my restless feet pressing down found no opportunity to pause. So when the car that picked me up from the Pittsburgh airport and drove me to my new home at my exile residence, that city of Asylum in Pittsburgh, I was excited to see three Robin bars sitting on the electrical wire outside of the house. for the first time since I left my home country, I felt a connection in this distant land when I saw the bars. So that's the something I knew of. And that night I wrote about them. Exile Poems 3. Out of the Fort Pitt Tunnel, my first view of Pittsburgh. The way we cling to a new lover is how these three rivers joined with my feelings. On Sansonia Way, the American robins warble sweetly on the words. You have come here as well, birds, to welcome me. The trees in West Park give me shade all summer. I hope you are understanding my pronunciation, or you are following the note.
Great job.
Thanks. This poem is the poem 4. This is about my inner world. Can you imagine I have rarely meet a Bengali speaking person during these years? Like I meet one or two person in like 2 years or 3 years. So it is not easy in Pittsburgh because there are not many people in the city from Bangladesh. So when I am at home, I listen to Bengali music and songs. I watch Bengali movies and I read Bengali books. Some of the biggest challenge is that I have faced in America cultural differences and isolation from my native language. Exile Poems 4. As long as I am in my apartment, I do not remember that I am an alien abroad because I glide in Bangla, smile in Bangla, live in Bangla. I read, I talk on the phone with my family back home. But when I open the door and I step outside to see a lowering, unfamiliar sky, I recall with a jolt that I am in a foreign land now. I walk a short way. When I see people on the road, I wish I could ask, can I lend you a song from my country? Is it possible? Yeah, you can listen. That's the meaning, like you can listen the Bengali song with me. So Exile Poem 5, this poem is about the winter, you know, the first snowfall. So I enjoyed my first winter in Pittsburgh, even though I do not like winter anymore. It's the last winter or the winter before, it was very cold. Yeah, before I think, and freezing and bitter and colorless and lifeless. So walking on the snow, taking the bus and navigating around these 7 years, it is not fun to live in this part of America in winter. So, Exile Poems 5. No one but me lives in my apartment. From the December window, I watch the first snowfall, a beautiful melancholy day, like a great painting on a white canvas. That day, I don't even want to know the names of the flowers in the store, just that I love them. The way we love someone at first sight. I write these things in letters sent across countries to the new addresses of my friends. I believe in love at first sight. I am that romantic person, one of them. So I wrote Exile Poem 6 almost 7 years ago, but still I read again and again, and I surprise because I forget my poems. So I always after reading my poem, I feel surprised to realize the elements of my poems are still valid and relevant to me. Achieving freedom is not easy, so I have been working on it for a long time. So I look into the moon, and I think sometimes I look into the moon at night, and I think this is the same moon and stars that my mother and my family members can look up to. And that gives me some kind of comfort. So I know they are missing me too, you know. So Exile Poem 6, the sound of the seashores to these hills, I wait to hear it on the wind. A blinding white light rouses me at midnight. When I open my eyes, impossible moonlight streams through the window. The sky is distinct, bright, but my future is shrouded in darkness. For my life in exile is dependent on the politics in this country. When I wake up very early, I wish I could take wings from the window of this destroyed house to fly toward the Kirtankhola River of my hometown. Yeah, it says, here I wrote, like, for my life in exile is dependent on the politics on this country. Think about 6 years ago, I wrote about home. The different time. Obviously, it was like Trump time, you know, and that I tend to mention. So exile poem 7, but I had lost so many struggles, but life goes on, life like a river, and it does not stop for anyone. And the things of my life that I have enjoyed most of my life, they are far away from here, 8,000 miles far away. And my family, my cats, my plants, my books. Recently, even the furniture in my family's house has been repainted. Those became old. My one cat died this year. My nephew died in 2017. But I am still keep going forward, not backward. Exile poem 7. Asking questions from a distance seems so very simple today. Write down poetry notebook, my secret alphabet, laughter, and garlands of tears. I planted you, carambola tree. How are you today? Have the books on the shelves been swiped away by dust already? Have my favorite cats forgotten me? Will I never see them again? With these questions in my mind, I stroll in the streets after dusk. In Exile Poems 8, I am narrating my dedication to completing my journey to be an immigrant. A person's voice goes quiet if the person cannot complete the journey, because we just want to hear the success story, who is successful, just hear their story. But a lot of people, they do not become succeed, and we do not basically give them a stage, I think. So because I focus on celebrating the result of victory instead of the perseverance along the way. So Exile Poems 8, it is much colder. Everyone is saying winter is here for real now. I pull my hat lower over my forehead. My jaw is stiff, my eyes is still gazing into the distance. I see frigid, full of self-confidence. The silence suits my writing life. Where is the person who has spent all summer setting off fireworks in the sky? At 2 a.m., standing by the window, I jump at the sound of them going off. I keep looking for him. A human life is like fireworks. So being an immigrant, I often feel out of place, because the struggles to go from an asylum seeker to citizen, that takes a long time. It's almost like, for some people, 15 years. And a lot of attention to detail. So when I wrote this poem, Exile Poem 9, I was concerned that my life passion and love for writing that I developed in Bangladesh would continue to be meaningful and successful to me and my readers in the US. Exile Poems 9. Everyone is celebrating the new year. I don't know how many ways I can try to make the year meaningful, to make myself and my writing matter. I often answer my curative questions to myself with these words, I don't know. The sound of fingers drumming on a bar. I see people trying different methods to hide their restlessness, unknown to themselves. When the migratory birds still return home in the evening, I don't know why I am surprised. Every journey ends in a return. Mine has not been born yet. It's true, mine has not been born yet, because some 7 years, even I cannot travel internationally, so it's hard. but I think I hope I will be able to do that soon. Exile Poems 10. So in my hometown, Borishal, there are many rivers, canals, and waterways which support the local economy with fishing and trade. So when I first arrived, having never lived outside Bangladesh, I found myself searching for similarity in my life back home. So I felt comfort to visit three rivers that flows through Pittsburgh and enabled it to thrive through these years. Exile Poems 10. I go to the river, pause, and try to fathom where the heart of the Monongahela lies. It flows differently by day and by night, just as our lover grows beauteous in the season of love. Foreign rivers don't reveal much to me. If I can't read their faces, then who can? I have seen more illness, I've seen more blood than I have seen people's faces. I'm going to read Exile Poems 11 in Bengali. By that you can hear the sound and sensation of my home language. So it's a very small poem. I will not take much time. নির্বাসিত কবিতা ১১। কেউ জানতে পারবে না আমি কে, আমার শরীর চেরাই করেও জানতে পারবে না আমার চামড়ার আড়ালে কে আছে। তুমি আমাকে ততটুকুই জানতে পারো, ততটুকু আমি তোমাকে জানতে দেই। রাস্তায় কেউ একজন চাপা স্বরে বলে ওঠে পেছন থেকে তার পরিচয়, সে একজন রিফিউজি। থ্যাংক ইউ সো মাচ।
Thank you so much. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. Now we happen to have tonight two poets who were from Bangladesh. It happens. Doesn't happen all the time, but sometimes. Shaheen Dil was born in Dhaka, Bangladesh, and has led a peripatetic life traveling throughout the United States. And around the world. She has worked in both academia and business. Her poetry has always been, however, her avocation. She currently lives in Pittsburgh, Manhattan, Manhattan sometimes. She's a member of the Pittsburgh Poetry Exchange Workshop. Her poems have appeared in Uncritical Quarterly, Four Quarters, Journal of South Asian Literature, Pittsburgh Quarterly, and two anthologies. And Shaheen's first book of poetry, Acts of Deference, was published recently in Sofia, Bulgaria. Please welcome Shaheen Dil.
First thing I was doing, Lord, I'm like a great Bible. Good evening, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. Okay, good. My hearing belonged to me. Wonderful. So we didn't plan this, but my first poem is also a little bit about Bangladesh and a little bit about the United States. You will notice throughout the evening that my poetry does lurch back and forth between Bangladesh and Asia and Pittsburgh and other parts of the world. When words are a little bit too complicated in terms of referring to either Islamic or Hindu mythology, I'll explain them ahead of time. Even though normally I just like to let the poems speak for themselves. a few years ago, I saw some Bengali fishermen building a nauka, which is the Bengali word for boat, on Narsingdi Ghat. And it reminded me of an incident a couple of decades earlier when I had seen a former colleague of mine having a yacht built for himself, and we watched it being built through the camera on his work computer. Very different men, very different boats, but there was a passion between them. The boat maker's art. I watched the boat as it was built, the shine of wood, the decadent lines of it, hand-polished surfaces gleaming, sleek, tempting, half done and up on trestles, looking for all the world as if it wanted to leap into the water, sails unfurled, bow springing above the waves, stern slicing through sprays of spume. The boatmaker's hands gentle, sanding the sides. Unaware of the camera's gaze, voyeurs peeping through lenses, trained on his hands, he worked while we watched, absorbed and unconcerned, secure in his place as master builder, a yacht with sails, no fiberglass, no engine. I imagine Galatea being chiseled with that precision, the maker chipping at her perfect form, fusing design to desire. Two, on the Ganges Delta, crisscrossed by rivers, fishermen abandoned wooden sailing boats and dugouts, designs over 3,000 years old. In Narsingdi Ghat, boat builders stand ankle deep in mud, lungis hitched up around their hips, building power boats and motorized dinghies using traditional tools, hammers, nail, chisel, wood planer, bow saw, lathe, and mass-produced engines, cheap, efficient, the fire of focus in their eyes. Their hands gentle, the hull bending to their touch. These boats are both love and livelihood. They are to fish, to eat, to live, to race. Not to be confused with Bangladesh's shipbuilding industry in the dockyards at Buriganga or Chittagong, vying with China, Japan, and South Korea to export ocean-going vessels and warships. Back to prehistoric preeminence. In 1770, Bengal built 223,250 tons of ocean-going ships, compared to just 23,000 in the rest of the American colonies. We'll get there back. Three, Damaji, boatman, launches his finished nauka, beating back thick fronds of lotus leaves clustering the edges with his long pole. Slicing through pink blossoms, the boat glides into the river. Put, put of the engine starts, black fumes trailing behind. Nets cast into the deep of the inlet, marked by buoys. He will return before dawn the next day to harvest his catch. Four. The Apache Star, a fiberglass monstrosity, dove into the water like a red rocket. Engines roaring, achieved speeds of 115 knots, set a world record from Miami to Havana and back. Five. Charon lifts up his oar, pushes off from the edge. The ripple of black water makes no sound. I make lists obsessively, so obviously I had to read one list more at least. This particular poem is after Wisława Szymborska's Possibilities. Lists again. I prefer bharta to biryani, white wine to red, and most of all, a place in the shade to sit, eat, and if I'm lucky, read. a murder mystery with a lady detective, a romance with a feisty heroine, poetry, not diatribe, and a blue ink pen to underline the words I like or love or don't know. A yellow pad to jot down thoughts, words to borrow or steal, a glimpse into another life. I make lists of things to do, cross them off when I succeed. If I've done something not on my list, I add it so I can cross it off. If that's cheating, so be it. I wish I were Catholic, so I could just go and confess my list of sins to some unseen priest who would forgive me in a grave voice and send me back into the world innocent and absolved. Getting right back to Pittsburgh, I'm very bad at giving directions. Giving directions. A visitor asks for directions to Murdoch Farms. She wants to see the fancy homes. I can't remember the way, so I say, go straight and make a right at Rite Aid, all the way up Whiteman Street towards Forbes. Past the large white house where 30 years ago a teenage girl was pierced to death by a katana at 3 a.m., having let in her drug-addled friend by disabling the security system. The neighbors heard her cries, but no one came to help. I was at a party when I heard the news, tremors. I couldn't sleep all night that night. Imagine the surgeon father trying to resuscitate his broken child, the wild-haired mother who couldn't even scream. Be sure to make that right before you reach Forbes. That's the place you want, the fanciest homes you ever saw. And as I warned you, all my poems are lurching back and forth, and August is no different. Then, when the black nightingale returns to the forest, when the audacious sun is high, I wonder beneath the waves where a few more wind beats would have taken me. When autumn is almost upon us and the wheat is high, apples turn red among the green and golden leaves, my heart unwinding begins its slow descent into the lion's mouth, forgetting the unchangeable past, the years that turn and turn, implacable, the wheel of fortune oiled and relentless, takes me again to the blue slide park, still echoing with my children's high laughs, a kestrel bouncing off the horizon, azimuth, azimuth, alpha and omega. This next poem is also about a river. And I refer here to Rudra, the Hindu god of wind and storm, and Draupadi, who is a heroine in the great Hindu epic, the Mahabharata. She is in one scene, she's captured by an evil king who, in order to shame her, attempts to have her undressed in public, but she's wearing a sari, which is 6 yards of material which you wrap. I would have worn one tonight, but I didn't want to spend the whole evening thinking about not having it fall off of me. So, yeah, I do wear it sometimes. But a miracle saves her because the sari continues endlessly. River at night. Even at night, the river uncoils from its source like smoke, like stone, a song unfolding from first notes. How to name this flow which has no form, no definition, this promise of continuous change, always the same, can we believe what we perceive? Is this a mirage, ignis fatuus, the way Rudra, the rough god, declares the wild heart admits no word, the way incense curls upward, delicate, ephemeral, a tenuous link between temporal things and divinity. the way Draupadi's sari unfurls, unfolding endlessly, a river of silk uncoiling. Lately, I've been thinking a lot about aging, so this poem is called Little Old Ladies with Silver Hair. I've joined their ranks. These days, when I board a plane, young men offer to help before I even have a chance to look helpless. When I ride the subway, young women jump up to give me a seat. Once so pregnant, she looked ready to pop. These days, when I feel a twinge, it's not Vronsky's well-earned pleasure at muscle ache after a vigorous workout. More like moderate acromial clavicular arthrosis or the mild glenohumeral kind. These days, I wonder, should I learn to play mahjong, bridge, bingo, take one last painful swing at golf? If this is all there was to be, the smoke and mirrors of a life well-lived, a faithful and devoted husband, two loving and successful children, mortgages paid off, dinners out with friends. Was there a turn I missed? A place I could have said, this way and I go thusly, that and somewhere else? Should I write a zuihitsu? Or is that inappropriate expropriation of someone else's culture? Should I add odd symbols to my words, throw in random that is to says, abandon punctuation altogether? Should I shape my stanzas into obelisks or turds, mimic MFA symptoms beloved of editors? Or is that a youth disease? Perhaps just tell me what I know. The baobab tree's roots rise from dusty soil, black branches break the sky like dark lightning, and on the path below, the rattle of beggars shaking tin cans, hijabi women scuttle home before the storm. I have seen the crumbling bricks of the house where I was born, the balcony with the rusted railing, on the street with tea shops, like the one my great uncle ran, where my three-year-old self danced and begged for sips of the sweet syrup. I have seen the field where my father spoke to crowds of tens of thousands, my four-year-old self in a blue silk garara hid behind the speaker's podium. I have seen the river run amok with monsoon rain, spill on the mudline of the banks, the gray water froths, roils. In their depths, the reflection of my mother as a young girl standing on the Noka's prow, not saying goodbye to her friend, knee-deep in water among the lotus blooms. If there were a way of returning to that beginning, would I go back? Or stand here in the checkout line at Costco, wondering, should I go back for the dried shiitake mushrooms? I'm going to end with two short love poems because no reading is complete without a love poem. And the Balam Kali, by the way, is a boat race in Kerala, India, where the boats have to be in the shape of snakes. Dialogue. I cannot say it will be different this time, that the yearning of clouds to be rain will fail, the singed leaves will float up to meet the sky as if better things were happening up there, where we cannot see threads plundered from the sky, hours uncoiling. The stars continue to burn, explode into darkness. The Balam Kali unwinds again, snake boats race against the river's ripples, and on the shore, ankle deep in mud and lotus, each side cheers on its champions. Love, you have gone where I cannot follow. I listen to the drip of water on stone. And this last one is called Insomnia in the City. Unless the moon in Sagittarius comes clean, confesses to the murder of sleep, unless the windless whisper of leaves grieves for summers wasted on the street, unless the memory of breeze is something we can peep, unless we sense the drift of last year's sunsets creep into the day, unless the things we dream begin to breathe, Pinocchio in Geppetto's hands. Unless words come in the night like a gift from the past, which fades in sunlight slowly until the shadow of its shape is all that's left. You will not come home again, and I will count the stars instead of sheep.
Barbara Edelman's poetry collections include All the Hanging Wrenches and Dream of the Gone from City, both from Carnegie Mellon University Press, and the chapbooks, and two chapbooks, Exposure and A Girl in Water. Her poetry and short prose have appeared in Pleiades, Prairie Schooner, Raleigh Review, Rattle, and Spillway, among other journals, and in several anthologies. She is a teaching professor emeritus and current part-time instructor of English at the University of Pittsburgh. Please welcome Barbara Edelman.
Thank you, Mel. I want to thank Shaheen for being a reasonable height. Is this okay? Oh, I'm so glad Celeste is here. Okay. Thanks. So speaking of getting old, I'm reading from All the Hanging Wrenches, and this book does a lot of looking back into various times of my life. This first poem is about summer camp. Though dark had swung full down, and the low holler of stream become just one of many voices, along with bug jabber, rustle, and the ball keen hammer of the woodpecker. Though the sun had plopped out of the sky, and starlings bunched on branches against a still gelling moon, I stayed along wet stones, the creek lit silver, catching tadpoles on their squiggly route through shallow water with the boy in baggy jeans and a striped shirt that buttoned, son of the man who mowed lawns at camp, who drove a square open cart and fixed toilets when mice fell into them and drowned and clogged the pipes that ran beneath the mess hall and bathrooms. A sad, quiet boy. Maybe he wore suspenders. And maybe brown boots he set on rocks with dark socks stuffed in them. He had a pail, I'm sure of that. And with our pants rolled up, we stepped barefoot through the creek on slippery rocks, snagging tadpoles in their orbit. Not for any torture some other boy might have dreamed up, but just to cup the squirmy, snot-body things in our hands and let them swirl in our bucket before we slid them back into the eddies of the moving creek. I forgot where I was supposed to be, the cramped cabin with the girls in short sets who could keep their shoes clean and never lose things. I forgot the blocks of time that corralled us and the riding of bored horses in a line who stopped and started as a line, one horse's nose against the next one's butt, who had no use for my perfect neck reining. At the creek with the boy who sometimes rode in the cart with his father, I waded among quivering tadpoles
and felt the stream ripple between my toes until counselors formed a band and carried flashlights and called for us across the darkened woods. I didn't say thank you to the other readers, and thank you to Joan and Chris, and thank you all for being here, and thanks to White Whale. The other readers made me switch course and read. I want to read one poem that pertains to immigration. Little House of Steel. There's a roasting pot in the shape of a house, heavy and silver, a roof built for snow, with weather vane handle, pot of an old world kitchen, kitchen of candles and glass, kitchen of lemon, of linen, of light through an open window, kitchen of linger, of lime, of a long line of broad-shouldered women, young broads in the rupture of nations, the deportations, split the towns, split the houses, split the women, cross the ocean, slap the cards on the table and puff your palm malls. Filterless, nicht gefährlich, Gott im Himmel. New, you should live so long. So long, Aunt Rose of the spicy mouth, Aunt Anna, Aunt May, Aunt Belle of the two-toned hair, Belle of the family, of the husbands, one, two, three. So long, so long. And yet the oddness of the house pot, its cool hammered heft, too pretty for peas, too heavy for lifting toward the finely set table of smuggled crystal, table of lace, of glass, table of borrowed children, little house of silver, too small to protect you. Simile. At Costco, there's plastic like glass, plastic like wood, plastic like flesh, plastic like metal, plastic like plastic, cherries like cherries, but a little bit like plastic. A handsome poet once asked me, why don't you write this line as a direct comparison? Not she had a face like an apricot muffin, but her face was an apricot muffin. Because nothing is really like anything else, is it? He smiled like butter. He smiled as if the beauty of his own face made his assertion logical. This was a long time ago, before Costco entered my poems, before I knew plastic entered the guts of animals. My poems were full of webs and water bugs. I wonder, is there currently a movement against similes? Nothing is really like anything else, but something really is something else. The next day, I wrote the word simile on the blackboard. The fourth graders read it as smile. Some of them clapped and jumped up and down. They wrote similes like boomerangs. They made me smile so deeply my bones felt like teeth. I've simile'd my way out of more than one situation. You should simile more often, a man used to tell me. He was like another man who used to tell me the same thing. He also said, you have a simile like no one else's, though in fact, it's very like my sister's and my niece's. A simile is like a smile with two chameleon eyes scoping in two directions, or like a stretched smile, a smile that goes on like a river. Because it's summer and we're in Pittsburgh, well, it's supposed to be summer. I think about the famous fictioneer Chuck Kinder, who was a much beloved friend and teacher to many people. And this is in memory of Chuck Kinder. It's called West Virginia. Because the day is warm and sweet with breeze, and because I won't be driving anywhere anytime soon, I think of you and how I'd think of you when I drove south. Because you asked me once, did I notice how the air churned just a little sweeter when I crossed the border into West Virginia?
And did I roll down my windows, breathe it in, crank up some Lucinda, and floor the pedal? And just like that, I became the outlaw you'd invented. No longer the reliable, uncoddled daughter of the humid heart of the country. No, I was a lipstick face adventurer. My past a little bluer, a little redder than most would guess. A knife stashed in my boot, chased by demons of intriguing origin, barreling across the state line. Into air, into water. It was a moment that got away from her, a moment she got away on, a car that might have braked at the sea cliff, but didn't, and took flight. Mind like brush fire, inscrutable photographer, singer, mentor. It was a life that got away from her, and one she got away with for a while. Migration west to cantilevered houses touching sunsets. A sun that took its sugar hold on all beneath it until it dropped, loaded into the ocean. The friends who descended like grasshoppers onto deck chairs and steps. The herd of children stampeding into the pool, clutching stupid-faced, inflated horses, while adults darkened into their alcohol, and the so-good husband strummed an adulterous love song. It was a brush fire that got away from her. I think of the clown suit she donned for lunch with her ravenous therapist. I think of the beauty of the two children, boy and girl, dropped at a friend's on the way to the cliff. I see them holding hands, the way they did when they first moved from New York, the sides of their small bodies touching. I have two more. This is called Our Bodies. Our bodies followed us around like the sky. Few questioned our penchant for evaporation. We aspired to be whispers, moth-like on our true path to disappearance, as if some customized rapture, like a shop vac, would guzzle us up if we were thin enough, and if not, leave us flattened like houseflies. In locker rooms, the bodies of the lovelies glowed like fishbone. They moved within the follow spot of our envy. Blessed are the starving mice that eat their own tails. Blessed are the kneecaps unveiled like the bald heads of babies. Remember when we pulled away from ourselves like riptides? Remember when we lived on pomegranate seeds and our mothers bargained our release, hauled us back into the land of gin and tonics, of Ames chairs and the glass party table, of cigarettes arranged in a silver top hat and cow tongue on a green ceramic plate, of red-faced adults with bloat white voices who cornered us between the kitchen and bathroom, and we sought to weigh less than mosquitoes. This last one, the first line is also the title. Today on the car radio, someone said research conducted by someone somewhere concluded that talking to yourself is a good thing. Excellent news, I said to the radio. I'm in the hills of Georgia for 2 weeks, alone in a dilapidated house with no internet, cell service, TV, or radio. People with higher IQs tend to talk to themselves, said the car radio. Talking to oneself does not indicate that one is crazy. Rather, it improves focus, alleviates anxiety, and facilitates working out problems. What a relief, especially since a few days ago, the car radio told me loneliness takes several years off a person's life. Well, define loneliness, I said to the radio. When I had a cat, I chatted with her, despite her clear look of boredom. When I'm with another person, I sometimes feel we're both talking to ourselves. A rather pretty flying insect alighted on the pine table this evening to join me for dinner. I question whether I'm actually lonely, I said to the insect.
So we sort of promised ourselves that we would read one poem by Jimmy Savetic each night for during this part of the series. And this came to mind partly because I have found myself sleeping more, I'm not sure why, and having these really elaborate dreams, and also feeling way down, and also having sort of just experienced the existential angst that I think is pretty hard to miss these days. And Jimmy has a poem for us also about trying to find somebody to blame for what's going on. Okay. A frequent preoccupation of people around the world. The poem is called Agony of Carrying a Blue Jug. Soon we will be in war with Korea. We've been in war with Korea for over 60 years. My guess is it has a lot to do with lies. Nothing to do with oil or rice or how you fuck their women. I believe it has all come down to which lie was told and which lie believed and which lie will become fact. I hate war. Maybe it's because it's always so close to our own deaths. Maybe pride, just maybe we kill for pride. It's raining in Pittsburgh. I'm tired. And I'm not tired. I carry sadness around like a big blue jug. There's a big blue jug on my head, and my head hurts. My neck becomes tired, and my legs hurt. I wish I could put the blue jug down, but the gods placed it there. Often, I hear screams coming from inside the blue jug. It sounds like agony, but I'm afraid to look. Who really wants to look at agony? I've seen it on the faces of the hopeless and those who have fallen out of love. Agony is sad, much like war. I wish I could blame the Irish, Italians, Russians, Greeks, Canadians, Mexicans, Jews, Arabs, Egyptians, or even if I could blame the rotten kid down the street. Every street has at least one rotten kid, one that would set a cat on fire, a kid that can only be loved by his mother who sleeps late and steals. I sometimes think that rotten kids are the ones that cause wars. I think they hide their rotten ways in tailor-fitted suits. I think they sometimes wear vests and hide their bloat. Men in suits that love the sound of rifles being fired and love to strut around with ribbons puffed on their chest. Some men love the sound of drums, mostly because it reminds them of artillery shells being fired. And I love the sound of drums, mainly because it makes me swing my big ass to the rumble of soul. I love to watch women swing their big asses to the rumble of soul. If men would do more rumba, there would be less war. Many innocent people get killed when there's war. They are always forgotten, as if their voices didn't matter much. I think the gods put their souls in the blue jug on my head. And I can hear their agony. I'm tired now, and I want to sleep. Place the big jug down and dream and dream. Thank you, everyone. So I really want to thank White Whale. They have become our homes. We are so grateful to them. They have wonderful books here, And the poets here have brought wonderful books. And especially those of you, you know, who do have those paper copies of Jeanine's poem, that doesn't mean you can't buy his book too, okay, because it's right over there. Next, 2 weeks from now, June the 27th, Ace Bogus, Deb Bogan, Mike Schneider, Judy Vollmer will be reading here. You don't want to miss it. See you in 2 weeks.